It was the year 1516 when an English lawyer and statesman named John Moore published a book depicting a fictional island society. It was an island society where there was no corruption, no greed, no war, but only a place of peace and absolute love of neighbor. What you see on the screen is actually a page from that book. It was listed in the back. Moore titled the book Utopia, which is actually a pun, because the word utopia, it comes from the Greek. It's made up of two parts, topos, meaning place, and you on the front of it, a negation of that, meaning no place. And what Moore was depicting is that there is no place on earth that really resembles this. No greed, no corruption, no war. Moore's point was that while we can imagine such a beautiful place and even long to live in such a place, there is no such place like it on earth. In our English usage, that word utopia has come to encapsulate that idea. A beautiful place. No more war. No more greed. But simply love of neighbor. Human beings have imagined and longed for such a place. Will it ever exist? Will it ever actually take place upon this earth? The book of the Revelation in the 20th chapter actually refers to such a time on earth. We get the name of this time from the 1,000 years that is mentioned repeatedly in the first 7 verses. We refer to it as the millennium. But when you read Revelation 20, 1 through 10, that describes this millennium, you have kind of a general outline of this time on earth when Satan is bound and Jesus and saints reign. But after reading those few short verses out of Revelation 20, you're left with a longing. Is there more description of this? What will this time be like? Who will be in this time? What will they be like? And the fact is, the Bible has a great deal to say about this time. Other passages, Old and New Testament, actually fill in some of the details for us in describing this future literal 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ on the earth. This morning, we are going to direct our attention to the 7th through the 10th verses of Revelation 20. But in order to do so, I need to fill in the picture for us. In fact, if we were going to look at these verses in particular, we'll come to this in the end, and we'll understand that these verses are talking about true colors, the true nature of things. And that is the title of the message today. I give you that in advance. But to get there, we're going to have to fill in some details about this time that will be known as the millennium that is coming upon this earth after Jesus returns. And so in order to do so, you need to hold your hand in Revelation 20. We'll be back there. But I want you to look with me at the Old Testament book of Isaiah. Isaiah in the 11th chapter. And I want to first of all look with you this morning at the conditions of this future time as described in the Bible. The conditions of the millennium. Let's just read through some of these passages and just note what's here and make some conclusions, some things that we can hang our thoughts on that will give us context when we go back to Revelation 20. Notice with me, please, Isaiah 11, and look at the first verse. We're told, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide dispute by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor. Let's stop right there. Who is being referred to as this shoot from the stump of Jesse, this one upon whom this sevenfold description of the Spirit will be upon? Who is this referring to? Do you know? Jesus Christ. This is the servant of God. This is the Lord Jesus Christ being spoken of prophetically in the time of Isaiah. But the question is, when is this referring to? At what point in the chronology of human history? Verse 4 actually helps us with that detail. Look at verse 4. We're told of this one with righteousness. This is speaking of Jesus. He shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. And with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. Has that ever happened? The end of verse 4. Jesus striking the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips slaying the wicked. You may recall from our study of the book of the Revelation, that is exactly what is explicitly described in Revelation 19. Just before that passage that speaks of the millennium, it talks about Jesus Christ returning and he will slay the wicked with the sword of his mouth, it's spoken of there. So chronologically, this passage in Isaiah 11 is actually referring to a future time, future to us, in which Jesus Christ returns to the earth, and this is what will happen. At that point, he'll set up his own rule, and it says, with righteousness, he'll judge the poor. In other words, he'll make accurate judgment and reign in a righteous manner. Verse 6 describes what happens next of Isaiah 11. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like an ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now let me ask you again, has that ever happened? This description of a peace coming even to the created kingdom of God, that the creatures that God has created, a wolf and a lamb together lying down in peace, that doesn't fit together in our current understanding. How about this? Has this ever been the case, the end of verse 9? The earth being full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea? Let me ask you, how do the waters cover the sea? Completely, right? That is total saturation. Can that be said in our world today? This is obviously a future time, and it's being referred to at a time after Jesus comes back to the earth. None of this has happened yet. It will after his second coming. But here's my question. It's talking about this environment after Jesus comes back. There's this kind of peace and even, in some sense, a reversal of the curse and the created order. But this is what's really interesting. The end of verse 6 talks about a little child. Verse 8 talks about a nursing child and a weaned child during this time. Where do those little children come from? if we're in a time of the millennium, and during this time it's the 1,000-year reign upon the earth of Jesus Christ, and yet it says, in that time there will be little children, as it's described here, born and raised during this time of the millennial kingdom. Where do they come from? Well, let's look at some other passages of Scripture to kind of understand this. We're looking at the birth of children during the millennium. Do you believe there will be marriages then, like we have marriages today? There will be children born like we have it today in our current context? If so, how is that possible? Who is inhabiting this place? Well, you don't need to turn there. I have this on the screen for you, but Zechariah 13, the Bible speaks of this time again. It's after the time of tribulation upon the earth. And after Jesus' return, it says this, in the whole land, and the land there is describing the land of Palestine. It's the land of Israel. And it says, in this whole land, declares the Lord, two-thirds, and it's referring to two-thirds of the Lord's people shall be cut off and perish, and one-third shall be left alive. I don't have time to take you in the context this morning, but it's talking about the context of Jesus' return at the end of this seven-year period of tribulation. And it says, by the time you get through all of that, two-thirds of the Jewish people will be cut off, but one-third will be left alive. And what will happen to them? These people, in their mortal bodies, having come out of the tribulation, seeing the rescue of Jesus Christ, as it were, coming from heaven, they will enter directly in their physical bodies into this time called the millennium. And they will go in their physical state into this reign of Christ. But they're not the only ones. I want you to look at Matthew 25. Again, stick with me. I'm just laying some context here. This is going to help us when we come back to Revelation 20 and look more closely at our text. Matthew 25 speaks of a judgment. Verse 31, these are the Lord's words himself. Jesus is speaking, and here's what he says according to Matthew 25, 31. When the Son of Man, this is Jesus talking about himself, comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. When is that? That's Revelation 19. We read that. When he comes with the angels with him in glory, and he removes the wicked, and this one-third of the Lord's people are passing into the millennium because he's rescued them. Look at it says in verse 32. Before him will be gathered all the what? The nations. Now, who are they in comparison to the Jewish people? It's the Gentile nations. It's all those who are non-Jewish. There will be people like that on the earth during the tribulation. Some of them will have survived. And notice what it says, verse 32. All these nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. Then the king, notice we're talking about Jesus in his reign. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you like this? When did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. Who are the Lord's brothers? I believe he's talking about this one-third of Jewish people that will be remaining. And Jesus says, as much as you understood that these were God's people and you welcomed them in at a time, remember, when Satan the dragon was out to destroy them, you took them in and you cared for them and you protected them. And by doing so, you demonstrated your faith in me. You demonstrated a right relationship under my rule. Therefore, enter into the kingdom in their literal, physical, bodily form. These are the people that now populate, as it were, this millennial kingdom. People in a physical body like you and I have. And what will be the conditions in that millennial kingdom with people in it, in physical bodies? Well, look back at Isaiah 65. You have the birth of children during this time, and now look at some of the conditions. Isaiah 65, and let's just jump right into the context. Look at verse 20. Here's prophecy of this time, and it's speaking of Jerusalem in particular, according to verse 19. And he says in verse 20, no more shall there be in it, or in Jerusalem, an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die, how old? Okay, stop right there. Anybody here know someone that's 100 years old? Okay. If we know someone that's 100 years old, would you say, yeah, that's a young man? No, we would say that's unusual for our time. Here it says, in this day, if someone dies at the age of 100, they would be considered a young man. And the end of the verse, and the sinner, well, that's interesting. During this time, there are sinners, but at 100 years old, they'll be accursed. Verse 21 of Isaiah 65, they'll build houses and inhabit them. They'll plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build another inhabit. In other words, people will be prosperous during this time. What they do, they'll actually reap the benefits of that. They shall not plant and another eat. Verse 22, the middle, for like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the works of their hands. It's talking about a time of great prosperity and longevity of life. And this is what will occur during this time called the millennium. Now, let me just ask you this. Our current life expectancy in the world is about 71 years. Just recently, on this planet, we passed the 8 billion mark. 8 billion people on the globe, just recently. That's with a lifespan of 71 years. Now, you have people entering this time of the millennium, Jews and Gentiles, as we've looked at. I think they'll be few in number because of the devastation that has taken place on the earth. But they're entering into the millennium in their literal physical bodies. They are having children. Those children are growing up in this time of blessed prosperity where the Lord apparently reverses some of the effects of the earth now and its curse. And people have these long lifespans like we read of prior to the flood. And what happens if life expectancy now is 900 years? What do you think the population of the globe will be at that time? Over 10 centuries. Well, it might be something like this. Go back to Revelation 20. Look at verse 8. We're told that Satan comes out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like what? Okay, we just passed 8 billion, and we can kind of total that. It's saying toward the end of this time of the millennium, these people in their physical bodies that are marrying and having children and the longevity of life and the peaceful conditions, it's like you go out to Rye Beach and you start picking up each little grain and counting. You can't do it. Vast multitude of people. But what is the condition of people that are born during this time in the millennium? Right? You have people that have come out of the tribulation. These are God-fearing people. They know the Lord, but they have children born to them. And what's the nature of those children? How are they born in this time? I'm talking about their fallen nature. They're actually born like you and I are into this world. Fallen, sinful. How do we know that? Well, you don't need to turn there, but Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 7, it talks about people during that time, nations who will refuse to come and worship the true king at Jerusalem. And it says that God will punish them for that. God will be swift in his justice when they don't worship the true king. How do you explain people in the millennium resisting the worship of Jesus Christ in person, except that they have a fallen nature? This is how they're born into this time period. There will be death in the millennium. Yes, longevity is long, or life expectancy is long, but there will be death. Again, I don't have time to take you there, but 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it says that in the end, the last enemy to be defeated is death. And that's talking about after the millennium, at the very end. That's talking about going into the eternal state, oftentimes referred to as heaven. So here's what you have. In the millennium, you have a near perfect environment. It is the best that has existed on earth since the time of Eden. You have the physical presence of Jesus for 10 centuries on the earth, ruling in righteousness from Jerusalem. You have glorified people. I didn't mention this, but you say, well, where will we be? Where will the people that know Jesus now? We will be there reigning with Jesus in a glorified body. Perfectly glorified, sin nature removed, reigning with him. You have glorified people. You have the removal of the curse, the wolf and the lamb lying down together. You have complete justice being acted out in accord with God's perfect will. You have the best of the Old Testament theocracy. God is ruling. You have the best of the New Testament gospel. The law of God is in their heart. The Spirit is present. You have those two things in this absolutely perfect environment. And yet, what happens? Now go to Revelation 20. Verse 7. When the 1,000 years, that perfect time, is ended, Satan's released from his prison. He will deceive who? The nations, whose numbers like the sand of the sea, verse 9, and they will march against Jerusalem to try to depose the king. Beloved, here's what this means. You have this best possible environment, and yet you have human beings who will not give their heart to Christ. They may conform to the outward. They'll conform because the righteous king reigns with a rod of iron and his justice is swift and complete. But when the opportunity arises, they will not give their heart to Jesus. And it will only demonstrate that. There's conformity, but not conversion. We know what that's like, don't we? That often happens in a local church setting just like this. You can have people that come in here week after week and enjoy time together with the Lord's people. And they look around and they get a sense around here that, boy, these are real, you know, kind of conservative people. They're really in earnest about what they do in life. They really try to be good people and outstanding people. And people kind of come in and they fit the mold and they like the conformity and they like the environment. But there's never any true heart conversion. In other words, if you remove the restraints of the community, their heart would go back to just what it was before. There's no heart change and bending to the rule of Jesus. That's exactly what's being described in Revelation 20, where you have this, not just a good environment, but like a local church, but a near perfect environment, and what is demonstrated but the true nature of humanity. Now, why does God have to display this? Why does God choose to do it this way? Because next week, Lord willing, we're going to read in the last part of Revelation 20 something called the Great White Throne of Judgment, and it is there that God will pronounce his perfect justice on people who fail to bend the knee to him. And if you read that out of its context, you think, that's horrible that God is so strict and severe. But it's these verses 7 through 10 that tell us it's not that God is so severe, it's that man, even in a near perfect environment, will not give his heart to God. The problem is not God. The problem is us. And so you have these people in this millennial period living on the earth. And what happens when now Satan is released? Secondly, I want us to note the insurrection that concludes this millennium. And now let's dig into the text of Revelation 20. What's going to happen now during these 1,000 years? Remember that Satan is bound. He's in an abyss. He's unable to deceive the nations. But now, the alternative to having Jesus as king is once again on the table. Satan is released. And now there's another option, as it were. What I want to note about this insurrection, first of all, is this. Notice the nature of Satan. Verse 7 says that when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan's released from his prison and will come out to what? Okay, here is a being made by God, fallen, placed in an abyss of smoky torment for 1,000 years. And as soon as he's released, what does he resort to? What did he do in the beginning? Remember Genesis 1? God created everything. Genesis 2, God created man and woman. Genesis 3, what does he do? Deceives. You would think that this being would somehow be reformed. But when he's let out, the very first thing he does is resort to character. Because this is who he is. He's incurably corrupt. And the first thing he does is say, who can I deceive and gather in attack against this one who dares to rule? That is his nature. That is our enemy. But what strikes me is those whom he deceives. Look at verse 9. It says, And they, who's the they? It's the number like the sand of the sea. It's those gathered from the four corners of the earth in verse 8. It's described as Gog and Magog because that's an ancient name describing the enemies of God. And it says they gather in this way as enemies of God, and they march up over the broad plain of the earth and surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city, that's Jerusalem. In other words, they're coming to depose the king. Now, Satan has been locked in a hole for 1,000 years. What have these people experienced for 1,000 years? Longevity of life. The blessings of this world. Eating the fruit of their own hands. Perfect social justice. Under the Prince of Peace. A righteous kind of rule. And what do they do? It's not just that they're neutral about this, but when Satan is released, they're actually antagonistic toward this righteous king. There's actually an enmity in their heart toward this one who rules. And they're just like those people who cried at the cross of Jesus' crucifixion, "We will not have this man to rule over us." And that's within all of our human breast, but by the grace of God. It's not that they simply turn away from Christ, but there's a coordinated attempt to destroy God's people and destroy and put down God's rule. Why? Because it's in the human nature. It is enmity against God. Beloved, do we not understand this? It's hard for us because you every day, you live with people who aren't here, who don't even claim to be believing people, and they are very kind people, and your neighbor shovels your walk, and your coworker asks you about your day, and they give to charity, and they demonstrate love for other people, and you're like, these people can't be angry at God. These people are good-natured. But it's not until you sit down and you start speaking to them about the things of God and even pressing in upon them the obligations that God has. I had this experience recently in speaking with a man. He's a good man. He does good deeds for people. He's kind. He's been very kind to me. Always cordial. We were engaged in a long conversation. I was showing him around the building, some of the buildings here. Finally, the time came where I was pressing upon him. I said, here's the real issue about, I'm not talking about religion, I'm talking about your relationship with God. And the real issue is to come to this acknowledgement first. You're lost. You're a sinner. You've strayed from the right path. And immediately, it's like he bristled a bit and said, I don't buy that at all. That's the thing that bothers me. I'm a pretty good person. Look at all that I do. But you could see in that moment when the claims of God were brought to bear, there was a bristling. Why? Because the Bible says deep in us we are at enmity with God. And this is what's on display. In the wisdom of God, he will grant 10 centuries of a beautiful time on earth, and at the end of that, in the wisdom of God, the true nature of humanity will be on display. The Bible speaks of this way. Look at this verse. 1 John 3 says this. No one born of God makes a practice of sinning. Notice it says practice. In other words, that's your character. For God's seed abides in him. Why can we not practice that? Why isn't that not our character? Because there's new life. And he cannot keep on sinning because he's been born of God. By this it is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of who? The devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is the one who does not love his brother. Here's what John is saying. The same writer of the book of the Revelation, he's writing this dichotomy. He says, listen, you know you're a child of God when God really has your heart. And when you do sin, you're grieved and it pains you. And you confess and you forsake. But those that don't, and actually run after sin and practice it, and it is their character, it is their way of life to go their own way without any regard for God, it says you're showing your true nature. You're a child of who? Of the devil. And God gives only those two options. Who is this devil? We looked at it last week. Jesus said this of the Pharisees, religious people. You are of your father, the devil, and you will, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, does not stand in the truth. There's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he's a liar and the father of lies. That deceptive nature. And your choice reveals your true nature. Friends, let me put it to you this way. What God is doing in his wisdom during this time of the millennium, people have been under restraint for 1,000 years in a perfect environment to obey the king. At the end, when the restraint is removed and there's other options, it reveals one's true nature. That's true of you. What would you do if you think you could get away with it? What do you seek when you can be anonymous? Now, I don't mean to unsettle the Lord's people here. People born of God do sin. But the answer is, what do you do then? Do you grieve over it? Do you look for help? Do you confess and forsake? People who do not know God, this is their character. Without any conscience, they run after it. And this is what God is demonstrating. What is the consequence in all of this? Look back at the text. Verse 9 says, they marched up over the broad plain, they surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, but fire came down from heaven and consumed them. There is a swift defeat. Fire from heaven. You hear that and you think, man, what is he talking about? Let me just ask you, has God ever done that before? In fact, Jude 7 speaks of ancient Sodom and Gomorrah as an example of God's righteous judgment on sin. And what did God do? He rained down fire on those places. Remember Nadab and Abihu? Religious leaders serving God according to their own imagination. Fire consumed them. This is a just response to people who have continually rejected Christ, though they've been given every opportunity. Pristine environment, the presence of the Lord, a glorified neighbor. And yet they reject that. Finally, there's this kind of destruction. Look at verse 10. Don't you just love this verse? The devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast, that's the Antichrist and the false prophet, were, and they will be tormented day and night. How long? Forever. This is the end of the deceiver. He will be no more. No more possibility. But notice his torment is not an annihilation, but it is an eternal torment day and night forever and ever. What are we to make of this? Beloved, neither prison nor paradise changes a person. The only way any of us are changed is through a heart change. Warren Wiersbe says, a perfect environment cannot produce a perfect heart. Our character is demonstrated when restraint is removed. What is Satan like? Well, when you restrain him and then remove the restraint, he's a deceiver. He's malignant. He's hopelessly lost. Here, what is in the heart of man, even in ideal conditions, when you remove the restraint of the rule of Christ and the options are on the table, it's like a dog returning to its vomit, as Proverbs says. Back to the old ways of rebellion. Friends, if you just put this in our current context, environment is not our problem. When you hear the talking heads today and the people speaking about the problems in the earth, what do they always resort to? It's environment. There's not enough education. There's not enough money. There's not enough opportunity. There's not enough justice. And if we just fix all of those things, what do we fix? We fix the people. God is going to make it known to everyone, the only way you fix a person is to radically change them from the inside out. And that's only done through the gospel. When people admit their enmity against God and bow the knee to the true King of Kings and receive Him as their only Lord and Master, that's how people change. Have you changed? Anybody can conform, look the part, say the right things, manage life for a while. What's really deep down in your heart? If you remove all the restraints, what's there? Is there truly a heart that is given to the Lord? Parents, let's not be misled in this. If you have a child who only obeys because they're under the restraint of your roof or the restraint of a youth group or the restraint of a local church, and when they leave and that restraint is gone and they go an entirely different way, that's just revealing of the character. Therefore, our answer is not always to think of terms in restraint and how can we keep them down and how can we keep people in a certain way and how can we make sure all the bad stuff is out. The answer is always the heart. How can I address the heart? How can I show them where they are before God? How can I demonstrate to them the truth of the gospel? How can I get them to plead with God to change me? That's the answer. God will make that clear. He'll make it clear in His wisdom and for His glory in the end. In ancient times, on the seas, sailing vessels were identified by their colors. See the flags on that ship? Where someone could look through a glass and look into the distance and see the colors that that ship was flying and know where its loyalties were. However, the enemy would often fly different colors in order to draw somebody in and draw close near that then it could engage in an attack. And because that was often the case, this idiom came to be known, what are your true colors? Where do your true loyalties lie? In the end of the world, God is going to reveal the true colors of humanity before he judges them. And I would just ask you today, beloved, where are your true colors? Who rules your heart? Where do your loyalties lie? Let's pray together.